Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Amy Levine. I'm Executive Director of the UC San Francisco Center for Gender Equity, and I'd like to welcome you to Women's Health Today, or WHAT, a series of talks and contemporary issues on women's health. Today's topic is Perfect Girls, Starving Daughters, How the Quest for Perfection is Making Girls Sick. And it's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Courtney E. Martin. She's a writer, teacher, and speaker. And Courtney has her master's degree from the Gallatin School at New York University in writing and social change. Her book, Perfect Girls, Starving Daughters, How the Quest for Perfection is Harming Young Women, was published to critical acclaim in April 2007. She also co-authored The Naked Truth, Young, Beautiful, and HIV Positive, the inspiring story of Emmy-winning activist Marvelyn S. Brown. Courtney is currently at work on a book about young people and social change, tentatively titled Do Graders, The Kids These Days and How They're Changing the World. I can go on and on with more accolades, but I think I will hand the microphone over to today's speaker. Please join me in welcoming Courtney E. Martin.
Thanks so much to Amy and the whole crew here. This has been a beautifully organized, really exciting honor for me. And it's just wonderful to be in San Francisco, one of my favorite cities. I want to begin by sort of talking about what the cost of not just textbook eating disorders, but sort of the huge, unlooked, sort of unexamined cost of obsessing about food and fitness, of, you know, having self-hating behaviors and thoughts. Because I think one of the big issues that we have to look at when we talk about women and their bodies is not just the disorders that are diagnosable, but sort of the, as so many historians have put it, the sort of body project and the loss of time and energy and a quality of life that happens. So I want to invite you to think back to the beginning of your day. You woke up this morning, your alarm went off, and your sort of adventure in body consciousness began, right? You had to make all sorts of choices from the time you rolled out of bed about your body, about what you put into it, about how you processed, whether it was attractive or not, what you had to do to it to make it presentable, et cetera. And I want to read you a little section of my book that's actually sort of commented on almost more than any other piece. So I'll begin here. One minute debating whether to have a bagel and be bad or a protein shake and be good. 2 minutes chastising yourself for choosing the bagel. 2 minutes contemplating how fattening the cream cheese was. 3 minutes poking your face in the mirror, feeling bad about the dark circles under your eyes. 4 minutes reading that Lindsay Lohan lost a bunch of weight. Another minute chastising yourself for being so vulnerable to media. 5 minutes thinking about how crazy it is that women as smart as you spend so much of their days obsessing about food and fitness. 2 minutes contemplating whether to just head for the salad bar at lunch or get the chicken sandwich you actually crave. 1 minute thinking how hungry you still are after your salad. 3 minutes milling around the snack bar wondering if you should just get one more little thing. 2 minutes trying to figure out when you should go to the gym. 1 minute standing in front of the coffee counter trying to figure out what drink is sweet enough that it tastes good but doesn't contain a lot of hidden calories. 10 minutes talking to your friend about how much you drank and ate over the weekend and how, quote, gross you're feeling. 5 minutes lying on your bed contemplating whether to go to the gym or take a nap like you really want to. 5 minutes wondering if your body looks anything like the girl on the treadmill directly in front of you. 2 minutes hating her when you decide you are much rounder. So this is just sort of a sample of the very subconscious or semi-conscious loss of all of this food and fitness obsession of sort of the average woman. I did this one day while sitting in the New York Public Library working on this book and trying to figure out, you know, how can I calculate this in some way? And clearly it's very unscientific, right? This was me just trying to get inside of my own brain at a time when I was most body conscious, which was in college, and think about sort of what went through my head on a pretty regular basis. I figured out that if we start thinking this way around the age of 12, and we continue throughout our lifetime being pretty obsessed, we could lose 6 months of our life. thinking about food and fitness. And this is not thinking in a way that actually produces any sort of health and wellness benefits. This is just sort of that grating, incessant chatter that is actually far more about appearance than it is about genuine health, right? And I found this shocking because most of the young women I know, and we'll get into that a little later about sort of the paradigm of femaleness that I see in contemporary America, but most women I know are so impatient that, you know, if they spend 6 minutes at a bar talking to an uninteresting guy, they're incredibly irritated. So I thought 6 months of our life should make us absolutely outraged. And in fact, I was outraged. As I said, was in college and I was sort of surrounded by young women who were the most brilliant, most wanted, most well-educated women basically in the history of America. And they were also incredibly obsessed with the size of their thighs. They were prone to anxiety, prone to depression. Some of them were involved in full-blown eating disorders. A lot of them were sort of playing around with disordered eating. I myself felt like I was always kind of on the edge of an eating disorder, like it was this contagious cold that I managed not to get, but was sort of playing around with different behaviors that were obviously unhealthy. And I felt like it had become the new normal, that it was pretty much accepted that this is the way it was just going to be. So I started asking around, asking alumni of my college, which was Barnard College, the all-women's part of Columbia University in New York. I asked my mom and some of her friends. I asked my big brother's friends, who were girls that I really respected. And I repeatedly got an answer that was some version of kind of a shrug of the shoulders and a sense of, you know, this is kind of how it is. You'll grow out of it, they'll grow out of it, or this is just what women do, right? We sit in front of bathroom mirrors and talk badly about ourselves, and that's how we bond. And I could not believe that these women who I otherwise found to be incredible mentors, who I respected so deeply, were basically telling me to be resigned, to sort of accept that this was how it was going to be for contemporary women. And I refused to accept that. So the book really grew out of the outrage I felt about that response. Just to give you a few of the basic statistics so that you have them, there are 7 million girls and women in the U.S. with eating disorders, 1 million American boys and men with eating disorders, and that's rising all the time, a really important subsection to be looking at. 70 million people worldwide have eating disorders, and as I'm sure a lot of you know, the basic eating disorder sort of diagnoses are anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, and EDNOS, which stands for eating disorder not otherwise specified. But what I'm more interested in, actually, is what I was talking about before, this kind of iceberg underneath the water of women who are pretty self-hating on a regular basis, whose quality of life is really affected by their obsession with food and fitness or by sort of subclinical behaviors that are obviously not healthy. In 1995, 34% of high school-age girls thought they were overweight. Today, 90% do. This is really significant for me because in 1995, that's when I was in high school. So to think that as disordered as I felt like a lot of my friends were, now it's that much worse is really significant. And in a really sad study, it was found that over half the females between the ages of 18 and 25 would prefer to be run over by a truck than be fat. And another two-thirds would rather be mean or stupid. Right? We could wrestle over the accuracy of these statistics, but for me, what is most important is the deeper meaning of them. What we're sort of sending the message to young women is that while we live in this sort of new age where it's important that they're smart and they have access to all kinds of opportunities, if they aren't beautiful, they still aren't technically successful, right? There's still this assumption that women can't kind of have it all unless they are stereotypically pretty. I think if that's really important. The other thing that I noticed, I interviewed young women of a range of ages, but mostly sort of 30 and under. And I found over and over and over again that women would sort of describe themselves as having never had a technical eating disorder, but having certainly had some kind of phase or experience that resembled one. I had a question on an email survey that I did that said, have you ever had an eating disorder? If so, please explain. And I got so many responses that said, no, but... And then what followed was this really painful and really telling story about some experience that this young woman had had. Things like, no, but I studied abroad in London and starved myself for 6 months. No, but I was an avid cross-country runner. I got a stress fracture in my foot, but I refused to stop. You know, my parents said I couldn't go to college unless I quit, and I would sneak out of the house at 4 a.m. and go on long runs. No, but I binge and purged once. My boyfriend caught me and said he would tell my parents if I didn't stop. Right? So these are stories that are not above the radar most of the time. These are stories that are considered not necessarily pathological. This is the new normalcy of this kind of behavior. And those are the women that, in my book, I want to speak to women who have textbook eating disorders and those who have recovered. But I also really want to speak to young women who think of themselves as apart from that world, even though they are actually exhibiting a lot of the dangerous behaviors that can be the slippery slope to that world, right? The majority of us who probably accept that our quality of life is you know, lessened just because we think this is how it is to be a woman, that this is normal to kind of hate my body on a regular basis. I think that's unacceptable. And so the book was my attempt to, number one, sort of say, how did this become normal? And then secondly, to say, how do we change it? How do we stop settling for self-hate and do all the really important work that all the women I know have to do in the world? When you start talking to women about their bodies, as you can imagine, you end up in all sorts of places, right? It's a pretty paralyzing subject to try to enter and kind of explore. You're talking about hip-hop music and reality television and spirituality and, you know, medical ethics and obesity epidemic and sort of this huge range of topics. So what I really needed as a writer and a researcher was some sort of organizing element, and I also felt like my readers needed that too. And that's where this Perfect Girl, Starving Daughter piece came in. When I was interviewing women, I started to really notice these two distinct voices that they spoke in, one being the Perfect Girl and one being the Starving Daughter, and even later had the revelation of seeing some of their journals in which they actually used different kinds of handwriting when they were in these two different sort of paradigms. So it became a really significant piece for me, a significant lens through which to kind of look at so many other issues. And I'm just going to read you snippets of the sections that explain that lens a little bit more clearly. First is the Perfect Girl. Perfect girls feel we could always lose 5 more pounds. We get into good colleges, but are angry if we don't get into every college we applied to. We are the captains of the basketball teams, the soccer stars, the swimming state champs with boxes full of blue ribbons. We win scholarships galore, science fairs and knowledge bowls, spelling bees and mock trial debates. We are the girls with anxiety disorders, filled appointment books, 5-year plans. We take ourselves very, very seriously. We are the peacemakers, the do-gooders, the givers, the savers. We are on time, overly prepared, well-read and witty, intellectually curious, perpetually anxious, always moving. We are living contradictions. We are socially conscious, multi-culti and anti-corporate, but we still shop at Gap and Banana Republic. We listen to hip-hop, indie rock, and country on our iPods. We make documentary films, knit sweaters, and DJ. We are social smokers, secretly happy that the cigarettes might speed up our metabolism, hoping they won't kill us in the process. We pride ourselves on getting as little sleep as possible and thrive on self-deprivation. We drink coffee, a lot of it. We are on birth control, Prozac, and multivitamins. We do strip aerobics, hot yoga, always go 5 more minutes in the limit on any exercise machine at the gym. We are relentless, judgmental with ourselves, and forgiving to others. We never want to be as passive-aggressive as our mothers, never want to marry men as uninspired as our fathers. We carry the old world of guilt, center of families, keeper of relationships, caretaker of friends, with a new world of control and ambition, rich, independent, powerful. We are the daughters of feminists who said, you can be anything, and instead we heard, you have to be everything. We must get A's, we must make money, we must save the world, we must be thin, we must be unflappable, we must be beautiful. We are the anorexics, the bulimics, the overexercisers, the overeaters. We must be perfect. We must make it look effortless. And this effortless perfection piece came out of a Duke University study in 2004. Duke sort of staff and professors and even the students themselves had noticed there was sort of a renaissance of very ambitious young women who also tended to be fairly unhealthy mentally and physically. And so they were sort of wondering, what's going on here? What is all of this kind of rushing around about? So they interviewed every single young woman on the Duke University campus, and out of that study came these two words with a whole lot of meaning: effortless perfection. That was what the young women at Duke described as their ultimate goal. And I was so struck by this, not necessarily because of the perfection part, because I'd been living that, I'd been seeing that, it was sort of all around me. But the effortless piece, to me, was the key to understanding what was so unhealthy about this new paradigm of female success, right? The in huge Herculean effort to make it look effortless is where we get diseased behavior, where we get all of this kind of self-hatred, shame, where we get some of the most sort of volatile mental health issues. And it's also where this piece, The Starving Daughter, comes in as far as my paradigm is concerned. This idea that the perfect girl is what we sort of show to the world, but the starving daughter is underneath and actually has a lot of wisdom to offer. But when this kind of starving daughter piece of us isn't listened to, can sort of emerge in some pretty unhealthy ways. So let me read you a bit of The Starving Daughter piece. A starving daughter lies at the center of each perfect girl. The face we show to the world is one of beauty, maturity, determination, strength, willpower, and ultimately accomplishment. But beneath the facade is a daughter, starving for attention and recognition, starving to justify her own existence. The starving daughter within annoys us, slows us down, embarrasses us. She is the one who doubts our ability to handle a full-time job and full-time school. She gets scared, lonely, homesick. She drinks too much, cries too loud, is nostalgic and sappy. When neglected, she seeks comfort in cookies, coffee, ice cream, warm bread, transgressions that make the perfect girl in us angry. The starving daughter emerges in midnight confessions, a best friend said in tears, a sweet mate buried in mountains of covers, shades drawn, eating ice cream in the middle of the day, and watching Buffy reruns in the dark. Current college girls tell me no one watches Buffy anymore, so this dates me, but I continue to proudly proclaim Buffy. Starving daughters are full of self-doubt. We don't want to worry so much about making other people happy, but feel like we can never say thank you enough times, never show enough humility, never help enough, never feel enough shame. We feel guilty. We fear conflict. We are dramatic, sensitive, injured easily. We are clinging to all kinds of attachments that in our minds we know we should let go of, but in our bodies we feel incapable of relinquishing. We are self-pitying, sad, even depressed. We are tired of trying so hard all the time. We feel like giving up. We feel hopeless. We want love, acceptance, happy endings, and rest. We wish we had faith, that we weren't ruled by our heads and could live in our hearts more often. We want to have daughters, little girls who will love us unconditionally. We steal little things like candy bars and bras that make us feel special for just a moment. We try to fill the black hole inside of us with forbidden foods. We never feel full. We always feel cold. We starve for God. We don't like to talk about this part of ourselves. Our whole lives, we have received so much affirmation for the perfect part that the starving daughter feels like an evil twin. Sometimes we can even convince ourselves that the sadness, self-doubt, and hunger don't exist, that we like to be this busy, that we like to eat small, unfulfilling portions or work out constantly for a while. But then the image doesn't come out right, or the phone doesn't ring when we want it to, or we get passed over for a job or a fellowship. Then the starving daughter makes herself known like an explosion. We collapse from exhaustion, or pick fights with our boyfriends or families, or sobbed behind the locked bathroom stall. Some girls experience their deep sadness in binges, food or alcohol, sleeping all day, sleeping around, buying a lot of clothes they don't need, ignoring professional or relational opportunities, dropping out of the race altogether. We hate losing control. We hate being wimps. We fight these breakdowns, but the starving daughter emerges, young and scared and sick of our shit. Young women struggle with this duality. The perfect girl in each drives forward, the starving daughter digs in her heel. The perfect girl wants excellence, the starving daughter calm and nurturance. The perfect girl takes on the world, the starving daughter shrinks from it. It is a power struggle between two forces, and at the center, almost every time, is an innocent body. So you can see that my research led me to conclude the thing that's probably intuitive to most of you in this room anyway, which is none of this is really about food or fitness, right? None of this is really about calories or pounds. It's about how we define a successful female life. It's about whether we feel like we're worthy being in the world just in the shape we're in, right? And so the issues get very deep very fast when you start to talk to women about their bodies, because it's connected to such sort of existential kind of crises. And one of the things that always comes up every time I ever did an interview was a young woman's relationship to her mother. I'm sure this does not surprise any of us. But it was interesting because it wasn't necessarily what you might assume, which is that, you know, woman after woman told me about how her mother had kind of initiated her into the culture of dieting. There certainly were those mothers. There certainly were those stories. But to the contrary, a lot of the young women I spoke to talked about how their mothers really would tell them, you know, 10 times a day how beautiful they were, right? Really had sort of been raised either in a you know, self-proclaimed feminist household or a sort of feminist is always already in the water household, where they were really sort of socialized to think that they should feel good about themselves. The problem was that many of these same mothers who were saying, you know, you're beautiful in one breath, in the next breath would turn to their own images and say something disparaging. Oh, I look like such a fat pig today, right? These are feminist psychologist mothers. These are, you know, teachers. These are journalists. These are all sorts of mothers who had been able to kind of adopt the talk, but not necessarily walk the walk. And so a lot of young women grew up with this anxiety around kind of, okay, well, she tells me I'm beautiful, but I watch how she feels about herself, and clearly there's a contradiction here. We all kind of know we're becoming our mothers in one way or another. So, of course, there's trepidation around watching a mother relate to her own body with a lot of negativity. The other piece that is a little larger is this idea that, you know, we were told you can be anything, and we somehow heard I have to be everything, right? And for me, that mistranslation happened in the modeling once again. Most of the young women I spoke to said, my mother is the most dynamic human being on earth, right? There's this like profound and deep respect that most young women have for their mothers. They would describe these kind of whirling dervishes of maternal energy who are, you know, taking on very traditional leadership roles in the work world and also still taking on most of the responsibility for family life, you know, taking care of aging parents, doing some sort of community volunteer work, often like, you know, saving children in Africa through some sort of nonprofit that they had founded themselves, like really dynamic, amazing women. But the sort of underside of that, the underbelly, was that a lot of these women were also very exhausted, very self-sacrificing, didn't know how to say no, didn't know how to take naps, for example. So what the young women were getting was this sense of, okay, being a successful female is about being really dynamic, but it's also about this profound sense of self-sacrifice and exhaustion and even self-hate. Right, that they were picking up on the ways in which their mothers compromised their own health to be everything to everybody else. And that's where we get this sort of super mom raising a generation of perfect girls. The other piece that's often missing from this conversation is that of the influence of fathers, right? It's easy to blame moms for everything on earth, and unfortunately we often do it. But fathers play a really huge role in the way that young women understand their bodies. Very obviously, fathers are the first sort of experience young women have of what to expect from men, right? So if fathers are commenting on their wives' bodies, if they're commenting on women's bodies on television or on the street, the message is very clear to a young girl at an early age, I will be watched, right? I will be judged. Men are observing me and critiquing me even when I'm not aware of it. And that's a pretty profound and paralyzing lesson for a young woman, as you might imagine. The other thing that I really noticed was this interesting dynamic between girls and their fathers, where dads kind of pretended like their daughters didn't exist, you know, from the neck down post-puberty, right? It was like all of a sudden the daughter is kind of this dangerous woman that dad doesn't know how to deal with. And, you know, we can get a lot of humor out of those moments. It's sort of funny that, you know, fathers don't seem to be able to kind of deal with the realities of their daughters becoming women. But there is a really serious and important part of that, which is that it sort of continues this cleaving of the two worlds, right? Women's world is messy and emotional and exhausting and intense, and the male world doesn't deal with all of that stuff over there, right? A lot of daughters have relationships with their fathers that are basically solely based on like intellectual talk or sports talk or kind of in these like less messy realms of existence. So it continues to kind of show that like male life and female life are very different. It also sends a message to a young woman that my body must be dangerous, right? If my dad's kind of freaked out about it and can't acknowledge its existence now that I've turned 13, what does that mean about it? Why is he so freaked out by it, right? That can be a really disarming kind of experience for a young woman. And I always tell this story of one of my interactions with my dad when I was around this age, because I think a lot of fathers get this notion that to have an authentic relationship with their daughters, you know, to resist some of the stuff I'm talking about, they have to have these like perfect after school special moments with their daughters where like the music pipes in and they say the perfect thing at the perfect time. But in fact, I think a lot of these very successful kind of scenarios look quite different than an after school special. And my dad and I used to every Sunday go to the grocery store together. That was like the one thing that he took responsibility for in the home as far as kind of the domestic work. And one day we were driving back and he sort of turned down the music and I thought, oh no. Anytime dad turns down the music, it means like some serious conversation is about to ensue. And he said, you know, he cleared his throat and he said, Courtney, your mom told me you got your period and I'm very proud of you. And I was like, oh, dad, shut up, right? Like I could not stand the fact that he just uttered the word period in front of me. I turned the music back up. I said, I don't want to talk about it. So you might assume this is a very unsuccessful father-daughter moment, right? In fact, it was very successful. It gave me the sense, even though I wasn't capable of kind of being open to it at the time, that my dad knew what was going on, and it didn't freak him out so much that he couldn't acknowledge it, right? That my body still existed, even with all this sort of craziness going on, and he still wanted to have like an honest relationship with me, which is a lot to be projected from this one seemingly sort of dysfunctional conversation, but it's true. I sort of always knew that he knew. And I think a lot of fathers and daughters settle for less than authentic relationships because they can't kind of stomach a little bit of discomfort, when in fact that discomfort can produce a much sort of healthier relationship over the long run. The other thing that's really new about the way young women are approaching their bodies is this sort of extreme makeover culture that unfortunately we're all a part of these days, which is really fed by reality television. Shows like I Want a Famous Face, which is a real show on MTV where teenagers would get plastic surgery to try to look more like their favorite celebrity. The Swan, if anyone remembers that, which is no longer on, thank goodness, but was on for a while, where, you know, women, particularly low-income women, would be sort of, you know, parachuted in, and in the course of 2 weeks, like their whole lives, including, you know, their psychological health, would be healed and transformed. And things like, you know, Biggest Loser, all of these shows where the real sort of underlying trope is, if you have enough willpower and money, you can look like anyone, right? So it denies the reality of physiological existence. It denies that we each have a genetic predisposition for certain body types. It denies that we don't have total control over what our bodies look like, right? It sort of furthers this very American idea of total control. And the problem with that, you know, in addition to it just being inaccurate, is that it creates a situation where young women will internalize a lot of shame and guilt over their own form, right? Because they think it's somehow in their control. I would interview, you know, young women, you know, 15-year-old girls who are like the center of their basketball team, you know, really strong, tall, broad women who came from families of, you know, Nordic background or something. And, you know, the young woman would say to me, I've always thought I could be a size 2. And it was heartbreaking because it was just literally impossible. But because this culture is so focused on the power of the will that, you know, it had convinced this girl that it was her fault that she was almost 6 feet tall, right? That there was something she could possibly do about that. So I think it's really important that we start to reinitiate conversations about actual physiological limits and sort of let young women release themselves from some of the pressure that they're putting on themselves based on this false kind of socialization they're getting from television. Another really important piece of the story is that, you know, eating disorders, diagnosed eating disorders, and also just disordered behaviors are no longer just sort of the world of wealthy white women. That's been a very sort of strong stereotype pushed, sort of reinforced in lots of ways by the media coverage of eating disorders. I'm sure if any of you thought about the last time you saw eating disorders covered in the mainstream media, the face of an eating disorder was probably a white, very thin, skeletal woman, right? That's the image of what an eating disorder is that the media pushes forth, when in fact, you know, many people in this room could be suffering from eating disorders. It's all sorts of body types. It's all sorts of race backgrounds, all sorts of socioeconomic backgrounds. And it really does a disservice, this sort of extreme media presentation, because it creates the sort of capacity for young women to look at, you know, the very skeletal white girl and go, well, I'm not like that, so I must be okay. You know, even if my quality of life is deeply affected, or I throw up twice a month, or whatever the case is, I'm not like that, so I must not be diseased, right? Which is really, really sort of a huge block between girls and the help that they need, because it's so easy to otherize it. There are lots of great studies looking at sort of the way in which eating disordered behavior has, you know, infiltrated, quite unfortunately, most ethnic groups. And again, this is a very global issue as well. You know, I've had interviews in India and all over the world, places that you wouldn't necessarily associate with kind of eating disordered behavior. Here in the U.S., there's a woman named Ruth Striegel Moore, who's at Wesleyan, who does some really significant work, particularly on black women's body image. And she's found that black women are as likely to binge and purge and more likely to fast and abuse laxatives or diuretics than white women, right? And then there's another huge study, 5,000 teenagers at a high school in Minnesota, where it was found that Hispanic, Asian American, Native American girls tended to report similar or more concern with the size of their bodies and as much or more eating disordered-like behavior as their white peers. This is incredibly important, not just because it's ethical that we recognize who's suffering, but also because it's deadly if we don't. There was a young woman at the University of Michigan during the time I was doing my research who had a heart attack, a young African-American woman, before she was diagnosed as anorexic, because it just wasn't on the doctor's radars when she walked in the room. So there's a real cost here beyond just sort of the ethics of recognizing who's really suffering. The other thing that happens a lot is white women particularly tend to kind of romanticize how women of color relate to their bodies. And usually, you know, you'll hear this like, oh, well, she gets to be Beyonce while I have to aspire to be, you know, Kate Moss or whatever the sort of Paris Hilton, the skinny white ideal of the day is. And it's a really false dichotomy, because the truth is that, you know, no matter what the ideal is, the important thing to look at is the difference between that ideal and how that young woman perceives her own body and that distance, right? That's the really significant thing to look at, not what the ideal happens to be. So I had a student, I teach at Hunter College in New York City when I'm home, and I had a student named Yadissa who told me, you know, it's the fat in the right places body that she was going for. She's this beautiful Latina young woman. And so because she didn't have a big enough butt for what she thought was ideal, she was in the gym constantly trying to get that butt, right? That is makes no difference whether she was trying to get the butt or trying to lose the butt. It's about the loss of energy, the loss of time, the distance between her ideal and what she felt like she really was. And so it's really important that we stop kind of romanticizing the ways in which women of color interact with their bodies. Another thing that people often bring up is this idea of the obesity epidemic, right? When I started working on this book and I would tell people what it was, they inevitably, so many would say, but what about the obesity epidemic? As if it were something totally separate from this conversation. And in fact, it's completely intertwined with this conversation, right? There is a $30 billion diet industry in this country that has furthered this discrepancy between sort of the feast or famine, right? We're kind of a country of extremes. We have a very hard time traveling a middle path when it comes to food and fitness. The really hard part is that you'll find that fat women, fat men, but fat women in particular, are vilified while the other end of the spectrum is glamorized, right? We've sort of done this kind of, there's a psychological concept called the halo effect, that when we look at a thin woman, for example, we sort of all of a sudden, you know, decide she's has a happy life and she's successful and she's probably loved and she probably has all her stuff together. And then we look at a fat woman and we immediately assume she's lazy, she's unhealthy, she's unhappy, she's unloved, right? These really absurd and completely disconnected kind of assumptions based on just a body type. So one of the huge downsides of all of the media attention that the obesity epidemic has garnered is that it's created sort of a newly socially acceptable discrimination against fat people. You'll find that, you know, when you talk to a fat woman, if really honestly about what her experience of life is, that she feels completely barraged with advice about what she should do differently, with assumptions about what she is or isn't doing already, that totally invisibilize, again, this idea of set body types, of sort of genetic predisposition, and also that, you know, there's unhealthiness on either end of the spectrum. It doesn't just exist on one end. So like I said, $31 billion diet industry fails 95% of the time, right? This is a huge key in looking at all the unhealthiness in this country, because it's proven that diets are the gateway to eating disordered behavior, right? I also want to talk a little bit about college athletes, because that's a big piece of the puzzle that often gets left out. We sort of think of women involved in sports as the panacea of girls' empowerment, right? Like, you go, girl, we're playing sports, it's awesome. The truth is, it is awesome. You know, I played sports very seriously as a high school student, and it gave me a lot of confidence in a lot of ways. But the underside of that, the piece that doesn't get talked about enough, is that a lot of young women use sports as sort of a cover-up for eating disorders, and or their dedication to their sport turns into disease because it goes unchecked. This particularly happens in cross-country running and a lot of sports that you would never think, you know, non-appearance-based sports. I'm not talking about ballet. I'm talking about, you know, basketball, lacrosse, soccer, again, cross-country running. And in one recent study, it was found that 70% of NCAA female athletes aspired to lose their periods as a sign of dedication to their sport. Right? So one of the things that is the first indication to a medical doctor that someone is healthy is actually being seen as sort of a sign of true, you know, martyrdom to an athletic career for women, which is really upsetting in a lot of ways. I'm going to quickly touch on these because I'm running out of time here. But one of the other key components is this idea of how women are socialized around sex, how young women in particular socialize around sex. And what I found in my interviews and in my own experience was that I think that there are kind of two really dominant voices in our culture at the moment. One is this pop culture message, which tells girls your body is your power, right? Learn how to use it, learn how to flaunt it. And on the other side, we have this very strong abstinence-only sex education message about purity and about the idea that, you know, girls' bodies are dangerous, they have to be careful, you know, don't indulge, don't experiment, shut off that part of your life. So real girls are in between these two messages going, what the heck do I do with this body, right? Apparently a lot of people have a lot of opinions about it, and I'm not sure how to have an authentic relationship with it. And so you see a lot of parallels in sort of the abusive, self-abusive behaviors around sex that you also see around food with young women. Okay, now that I've thoroughly depressed you, let's talk about what we can actually do about this, right? On the personal side, I think there are a lot of things that we can do literally the second we walk outside of this door, right? If everyone in this room actually decided that they were going to heal their relationships with their own bodies, we would have this incredible effect on the people that are in our lives on a daily basis. Sadly, most of the young women I interviewed said they didn't have a role model of a woman who really liked her body. Not one. So if each of us in this room can be that role model, whether it's for our own mothers or daughters or sisters or friends, we could change the world just by doing that, right? If you need help, you need to get it as soon as possible. Anorexia is the most deadly psychological disease in existence, and all of the other eating disorders aren't very easy to heal either. So if you can catch it early, you have a much better chance of, you know, getting back to a higher quality of life. Say it out loud. Say it to someone you trust. You know, make those voices in your head real by having candid conversations with people that you know you can depend on about what's going on for you internally. Never diet. Goes without saying, you know, 95% failure rate is not something I would buy into either emotionally or financially. Reconnect with your authentic hungers. Most young women I talk to don't know when they're hungry. They don't know when they're full. They just have very regimented ideas about what they're allowed to eat. So that's really important. And move in ways that make you feel happy. You know, we live in such an exercise-conscious society that sometimes I think a lot of us feel trapped by very particular recommendations of what we're supposed to be doing and how we're supposed to be doing it, rather than listening to our own body. And invite a compassionate voice into your head. You know, there's that other voice in there that's pretty consistently makes a lot of women feel terrible about themselves, and so I always kind of invite people to think about who really thinks you're beautiful and gives you a sense of your highest self, and how can you kind of bring them into your head to answer that other voice. And collectively, we can change conversations about weight to well-being. We can reflect on when and with whom we're most happiest and most beautiful and be around them more of the time. You know, you create your own social circle. I know a lot of us sometimes feel like we have to be friends with certain people, but I'm a big advocate of being conscious of how do your friends make you feel? And if they don't make you feel good, if they make you feel competitive or sort of adopt the psychology of deprivation, like there's only enough love or enough happiness for a few of us, don't hang out with those people anymore, right? It's the simplest thing, but it's something we often forget. Put your money where your heart is, right? Don't buy magazines that make you feel bad about yourself. Don't buy products that make you feel bad about yourself. You're sending a message to the producers of those products, do more of this. I like this. Every time that you put your money in that direction. I'm always an advocate of getting involved in feminism because it's this collective lens for something that can sometimes feel very personal, but in fact has like a whole societal implication that we can sort of work together to fight back about. And let's all sort of shift this paradigm of success from this achievement, appearance-based focus over to relationships and joy and fulfillment, things that we know in our heart of hearts is the stuff that at the end of the day really matters. And finally, one of my biggest sort of convictions is that intergenerational relationships are one of the ways that we can sort of seek our way out of all of this obsession. I think that they're incredibly powerful for both young women and older women, for young men and older men. And I want to end by reading you one of my most successful intergenerational interactions while on the road. I'm sitting at a picnic table with a chattering gaggle of 8-year-old girls high on their morning Pop-Tarts. They're sprinkling sparkles over pools of glue and telling me stories about their moms and sisters who, quote, get worried and then eat like only grapefruit and stuff for days, but then screw up and eat chips or something and then feel bad and then eat more grapefruit and stuff. I have come here to the Girls Inc. summer program in Santa Fe, New Mexico, because I'm hoping to catch a glimpse of the calm before the storm. I ask them what they think pretty is. One little girl with a voice as small as any I've ever heard and hair black as the crows perched in the pinyon tree surrounding us leans over to my notebook and writes with a stubby orange-colored pencil, "You are pretty. I think you have nice hair," and encircles her secret message in a big lopsided heart. "Thank you," I whisper in her tiny ear, tears threatening to sneak out of the corner of my eyes. This little girl thinks I'm asking these questions because I really don't know the answers. Suddenly, it occurs to me that she is probably right. I'm looking for wisdom from 8-year-olds with puff-painted shirts and stacks of brightly colored rubber bracelets. I'm not looking in the wrong place. I ask, what about in the future? Do you think you'll worry about stuff like your moms and big sisters in the future? A spindly little animal of a girl made entirely of tiny bones and taut muscles jumps off the picnic table with her arms splayed out from her sides in the shapes of wings, and she shouts, "In the future, there will be flying cars! In the future, we will all be beautiful!" And I say, may we all live to enjoy her prediction. Thank you very much. So we're happy to do Q&A if anyone has thoughts or questions. The question was, you know, how are you seeing this show up in younger girls ages 8 and 9? And the woman who asked the question said she has her own daughter who's 8 years old, will sort of make very body conscious comments. You're right on. The statistics show that these sort of symptoms are showing up earlier and earlier. They're also being diagnosed later and later, which is really interesting. The AARP just did a whole thing on how many older women are actually being diagnosed with eating disorders and being treated. So we're sort of seeing it stretch along the entire life spectrum. I think there are so many ways we can kind of pin that down. One of them is just early maturation, right? We have this compressed maturation right now where girls are getting their periods earlier and earlier, so they're forced to reckon with some of these questions about bodies and femaleness and, you know, sex and all of this stuff that's really loaded and very confusing. So I think there's that piece. And then we also have kind of the early sexualization in pop culture and in the media. I think girls are exposed at earlier and earlier ages to messages about fat being bad and thin being good. And you know, they trade it around among their peers in kindergarten and first grade and second grade. It's incredibly disturbing. So I totally empathize with you on that journey. But it sounds like got a mom who's pretty conscious about all this stuff. So that's great. Yes. The question was, could I speak to this showing up in boys and men? I'm not actually an expert on that side of the equation. I really sort of limited myself to women. But I did write a little bit about and interview men about sort of their increasing body consciousness and how that might create some empathy for women in terms of sort of what they've been dealing with forever. I always say it's not the equality we were looking for, right? Is that now all of these companies have realized they can market to men's insecurities as well. So you find, you know, special skin products for men and special hair products and more men getting kind of obsessed about their looks in a very normal way. But it is the actual diagnosable eating disorders are rising among men and boys, as I said. I haven't studied exactly what's happening or how that's going on, but I see all the sort of social and cultural effects of just men being in this culture that is recognized that, you know, they can be marketed to as well. Any other questions? Yes. So the question was, where does this thinness ideal come from, right? And how did the media decide to sort of embrace this as the only ideal? I think that is incredibly complicated. It's a really good question. It's a very complex one. We could sit here like for the better part of the rest of the day trying to figure that out. Some feminist theorists have this idea that the more actual power that women get, right, so the more political access they have, the more money they have, the smaller the thin ideal gets. So it's sort of like this really interesting push and pull relationship. I don't know if I agree with that. I don't know how I feel about that, but I think it's an interesting theory. I also think it just speaks to sort of our culture's obsession with control, right? Thinness is symbolic in our culture with control, with wealth, with all of these things that Americans are pretty obsessed with. And so I think it kind of fits into a larger kind of cultural obsession with will and with kind of the female American dream is thinness, right? Is that we can all achieve that if we work hard enough. So I think for me, that's reflective of kind of the broader contemporary culture. But, you know, again, there are all kinds of interesting theories about how that ideal waxes and wanes at different moments. Yes. The question was, am I aware of the diet industry's lobbying affecting health policy? I think there's a lot of suspicion and a lot of good writing on sort of the ways in which the diet industry is incredibly powerful. I mean, if you can imagine $31 billion of profit lets you, you know, fund some pretty good lobbies. The promising thing is that there's also a really new and invigorated eating disorder lobby, people who want to also pressure the American government to really talk about not just the prevalence of eating disorders, but the cost of healing them. Right? Most young women who become fully eating disordered will be in and out of a clinic 6 or 7 times. There is sort of a revolving door. And that revolving door is created by health insurance policy, which gives or withholds treatment based on physical symptoms. Right? It's the most nonsensical thing in the world. So if an anorexic girl goes to the Red and Fruit Center, for example, once her sort of metabolic stuff is all, her electrolytes are balanced, she's not at a, you know, life-threatening weight anymore. And keep in mind, this can still be very thin, but she's just not in a life-threatening stage. Many health insurance companies will pull funding. So then this young woman, unless her parents have a lot of means, is forced to leave the clinic before her actual mental health has been healed, right? So that's where you get this sort of revolving door. So particularly around those issues, there's this whole new kind of eating disorder prevention and treatment lobby group of organizations that is coming together and really fighting back. But yeah, in the negative side of things, I think the diet industry has very savvy and very long-tested, you know, political strategies for how to make sure that, you know, they're not questioned by, for example, the FDA or other, you know, the National Health Services organizations. Other questions? Yes. The question was, did I look into sexual orientation and whether that affects my findings? The whole field, really, about young women and sexual orientation is a really interesting one right now. I mean, first of all, young women aren't identifying as readily in one direction or the other. There's sort of a sexual fluidity that's coming about that makes it difficult to even pinpoint what that is. More women feel like they're quote-unquote bisexual, although most of them aren't even identifying in that way. So it's hard to do, I think, really accurate studies right now of young women because most of our sort of research methodology is very old-fashioned in the sense that it assumes young women would categorize themselves one way. But there are a lot of studies that show that women who are primarily attracted to other women are less body conscious, that they feel like the thin ideal is not quite as forceful a presence in their lives. So that certainly does, that research does exist. But again, I feel like for really contemporary stuff, we kind of have a void because a lot of researchers haven't yet caught up to this idea that women aren't identifying one way or the other very often. Maybe one more question or? Okay. One more, anyone? Got something burning? Yes. The question was about women getting their periods earlier. Yeah, girls are getting their periods statistically much earlier than they used to. And particularly women of color are getting their periods earlier. And there's lots of theories. I'm not really an expert in this area, but there are lots of theories about why that is. Some of them are about the food that we eat and some of the kind of hormones and sort of, you know, non-natural content in so much of the food that young women are eating now. There are some theories about the amount of media that young girls are consuming somehow can produce physiological reactions earlier. There's all sorts of interesting stuff out there. Unfortunately, I'm not an expert in all of it. But yeah, definitely check out the literature on it because it's really interesting. And it's really important because it's affecting girls' health in all sorts of ways that we wouldn't have intuitively expected it to. Should I do one more? Okay, one more question? Yes. So the question was, how young are we seeing eating disorders these days? And the questioner has a four-year-old daughter who said a few things, so she's wondering, you know, is it happening that young? I think you can rest assured that for the most part, it's not happening that young. It's you know, there may be anomalous examples where it has, but for the most part, the onset of sort of eating disorder behavior in its most pernicious form is really paralleled to getting your period, to menstruating, to sort of starting that transition into like femaleness and what that's all about. So you do certainly see, you know, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, that kind of quote unquote tween age, right? But a 4-year-old generally is still, that would be a real shock, I think, to most eating disorder specialists. Okay, well, thank you so much for being here, and keep in touch. Thanks a lot. Take care.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.